Hello, and thanks for being here. This is Margaret Malone, and you're listening to another episode of Bust the Canon, a literary interview series where we talk to writers about writers they love from the past, present, and future, the ones that are all too often lesser known than we'd like them to be, writers who are usually working outside the traditionally known literary canon that so many U.S. readers are familiar with. Today, we're talking with writer Michael Kopperman. Michael Kopperman is an assistant professor in the Department of Writing, Rhetoric, and Cultures at Michigan State University. His memoir, Teacher, 2 Years in the Mississippi Delta, was a finalist for the 2018 Oregon Book Award in Creative Nonfiction. He is the creative nonfiction editor for the Northwest Review. Kopperman was once one of the best wrestlers in the Western United States and attended Stanford on wrestling scholarship. His book, Seeking Kenny, which is just out now, is about the extremes of the American subculture of wrestling, as seen through the story of five-time national champion Kenny Cox's pilgrimage deep into the wilderness of Kauai's Napali Coast from the University of Iowa Press. Michael, hello and welcome. Thank you so much for being here. It's a pleasure to have you on the show.
Thank you for being here, Margaret. I was just thinking as you were reading about Teacher that I was like, and Margaret blurbed that book. Timeline with no time there, and it was so kind of you. So yeah,
I still talk about the book Teacher. I still recommend your first book to people. It's so good, and I am convinced it's going to have a long life because it does work that I that still, like, here we are, it still needs to be done. So anyway, thank you for writing the way you write.
Well, thank you for being an early supporter. I mean people like us was just out, I think, when that year, right?
When, our books came out right around the same time. Yeah.
Yeah.
You're on tour right now for Seeking Kenny. How's that going?
So I literally flew in this morning. I'm operating on about 5 hours sleep. So anything that I say that sounds a little out of pocket, I'm going to chalk up to that.
Deal.
But, you know, flew in from Detroit, but really from Lansing. So I had to drive to Detroit, which is a good hour and a half, and then hop a plane. So I'm a little bit jet lagged, but I'm super, super excited to do basically Oregon events for like the next, I don't know, 2 weeks or so.
Because you're an Oregon human. Are you were raised in Oregon?
Yeah, exactly. I'm from Eugene originally. Mm-hmm. Grew up there until the age of 18, and then I went to college and then to Rome, Mississippi to teach in the Black public schools there for a couple of years. And then I came back for graduate school. And I worked after grad school 16 years in diversity retention at the U of O. And I'm out in Michigan right now because my partner's out there getting her PhD in biomolecular science. And that just happens to be the best place to study that particular thing.
Mm-hmm.
So I teach out there, get some creative nonfiction, but I miss Oregon in the worst way.
Do you? What do you miss the most?
Well, so I think I have to say that part of it, and I never really understood this, but like, you don't really, I knew I didn't belong in Mississippi, which is a very flat place,
mm-hmm.
but somehow something about Michigan's version of flat, at least in the middle of the mitten where I am, is very different than even sort of Mississippi, because it looks in some ways a little bit similar,
mm-hmm.
right? There are some pine trees and forests. There are lots of deciduous like areas that look very similar to deciduous growth here in Oregon, but there's no mountains, and the rivers are slow and low
mm-hmm.
and brown.
Mm-hmm.
Not brown because they're dirty, brown because the underlying soil is sort of there, and it's not rock bed, at least in the areas that I'm near. You know, and so I get that, like, basically, the Lake Michigan is the beach. The Great Lakes, like, are this strange, you know, horizonless, you think it's salt water until you taste it, sort of a moment. And I think it's really beautiful there, but it's a little too far away for me to look at it regularly. And so what I find myself missing is just what I maybe not take it for granted, but what I sort of deeply love, which is, you know, the green and the moss and the trees. And honestly, even the, you know, even the temperature, it's about 100 degrees, 110 with heat index there right now, and incredibly humid. And I rolled into here today, and it's like, it feels like it's maybe like 70, 75, but it's that nice Oregon summer dry heat that's really just kind of lovely. And I was like, oh, this is home.
So I'm glad you're back, and I'm glad the weather is so beautiful for you in your return. Okay, so every writer feels different about going on tour and promoting their book. How is it for you? Do you enjoy this process? What's happening?
I think right now I'm filled with sort of like a lot of excitement. In part, it's because this book is really regional in some ways, right? And so it's been a difficult thing out in Michigan. It is wrestling country out there in the Midwest. And so the culture is there really deeply. But the landscapes that are in my book, a lot of them are Oregon landscapes. It's the Mackenzie River near Eugene. It's the whole Pacific coast because eventually Kitty Hawk sort of traverses that all the way to Baja and back. And it's most especially like just literally sort of like Oregon forests and Oregon people. And so I'm really excited to come here with this book. I have a Eugene release on Sunday at 5 p.m. at Tsunami Books in Eugene. That's going to be wonderful because a lot of his family and friends are going to come to that event. And then you are going to be super kind to host me on the 8th at Literary Arts here in Portland. I think we're at 6:30, right? And I haven't even seen that new space that I guess they created for the sort of
It's
cafe bookstore
beautiful.
area.
Yeah, it's really
It
beautiful.
looks really gorgeous in pictures, so I'm super excited about that. And that to have Portland friends come out. And there are some wrestlers and wrestling culture and people who knew him from Portland who I think are also going to turn out. And
Cool.
then I get to go do 2 days at Oregon Country Fair,
Oh my gosh.
which is going to be wild.
Yep.
But in terms of, as I don't know what book events exactly look like, but Kevin Samsel, who's like, a fixture at Powell's and everything, he and I are doing an event together, and I'm also doing an individual reading. And I'm excited to see what fair looks like. I have to confess, like, I haven't been to fair in probably like 10 years, even though I still live in Eugene. It's just not on my regular pilgrimage. But I grew up with, you know what I mean? I grew up with the fair kids. I wore tie-dye in high school. That's what the cool kids wore at South Eugene High School. So I'm looking forward to seeing some familiar faces and some friends, hopefully, out there.
For hold on. So for listeners who don't understand what the Oregon Country Fair is to Oregon and specifically to Eugene, can you just explain what the Oregon Country Fair is?
Okay. So, Eugene has this reputation that I think in certain ways has become, if not less deserved, because I think that leftist culture is still there, that legacy of the 60s, the sort of Nike town of it all has obscured it a little in terms of the image that it broadcasts. But really, Eugene is a place where you go to the Eugene Saturday Market every Sunday, and there's, 200 people banging on drums in Wigmore Square, and there's all kinds of people selling all kinds of wonderful food and goods and fantastic produce from all of the local farms, right? That's all sort of organic and beautiful and relatively affordable too, for that matter. And that's like week by week. Fair is this institution that's existed for years and years and years. And I think this is, I don't know if how many, I'm going to get it wrong if I say it, but I want to say it must be more than 50 probably.
It's got to be. It's probably more than that.
It's a network. Like it's kind of like it's not, the politics are different than Burning Man. They're not completely dissimilar, but it is another space. And there are going to be something like, I think it's something like 50 to 100,000 people are
That
descending
sounds
on
right.
this area outside of Vineta, which is just about 20 minutes out, 20, 25 minutes outside of Eugene. And they work year round on that property, and people organize and they work to grow food on the site. And then they have all of these different people who come who run booths and things. It's quite an incredible sort of like dream scene. And then there's live music. And apparently there are literary events that they've been doing for quite some years. Laura Stanfill is the one who connected me with
Oh,
us. So,
I
Laura
didn't.
is wonderful. Yeah.
She is wonderful, great literary citizen to the Northwest, and she, I didn't know there were literary events there either,
I
actually.
think she's one of the people responsible for helping organize them,
Thank you, Laura
among
Stanfill.
many. I don't know exactly what it's going to look like. But I didn't realize until I moved to Michigan that I miss hippies of the Northwest. Because like
That's a
all
statement.
because in well, at least in the area I'm in Michigan, in Ann Arbor, there's some of that culture. But for the most part, it's almost entirely absent from like the city of Lansing, which is both a state capital and a huge college town, and also traditionally like a formerly a factory town, right, for the big three. It's got that kind of legacy too. It's got grit, Lansing does. What it doesn't have is hippies. And like I'm out there and I'm like, oh, I'm the hippie now because I want to recycle. Because I literally can't get takeout from half the places in town because they still use styrofoam. Because the last American styrofoam manufacturer of large size is in Lansing and everybody uses it. And it's like my childhood environmentalist self is just like injured every time I'm given, you know what I mean? Like I can't finish my food if I go someplace. And it's, you know, it's like I miss that. I mean, I guess maybe I always was a little bit of a hippie. I just didn't wear a lot of hemp. And so
It would be hard to be raised in Eugene and not have that in you.
exactly. And I thought it was because in Eugene, I'm like, you know what I mean? I'm a
You're
square,
pretty
right?
straight, probably. Totally.
Yeah. But then I get to Michigan and I'm like, oh, I am the hippie now.
You're the super
Yeah.
lefty hippie. Okay. So before we get to the questions, I just want to check in and talk really briefly about Seeking Kenny. So, because listeners are probably not going to have read it yet, it just came out. Can you talk for a minute about, I guess what I'm always curious about is more process. So, how this is what I want to ask is how long did it take to write this from the time you started to the time now that it's being published? But I'm also interested, having read your first book, Seeking Kenny is. Every time I turn the page, it feels to me like it was hard to write. And like you're telling, like the writer's telling me something they wish they didn't have to tell me or didn't want to tell me or swore they'd never tell every time I turn the page. How how true is that? Like, what was it like to write this book and how long did it take?
It taught, well, the book taught me a lot. So how many years did it actually take? I mean, this book has an interesting genesis that I guess loops into the question of what I'm sort of working on now. So I was out on market with a memoir that contained one of the chapters of this book about cutting weight. And in that chapter, Kenny Cox sort of figures. And it was one of the sample chapters that I was sort of using as we were trying to sell this memoir on spec that was about sort of growing up in Oregon and how being bullied in white working class public schools had caused me to turn to sort of toxic warrior culture and how ultimately those masks proved insufficient. And I had to sort of turn back to my family examples on my Japanese Hawaiian side and my anti-Zionist Jewish side. And except the pitch wasn't that clear. The book was a bit of a mess. Yeah. And what an editor at Simon & Schuster got a hold of the sample chapters, and he came back and he said, I don't want this other book, but I want a book about Kenny Cox. And he was like, it's greenlit, it's 100% guaranteed, right? You know what I mean? Like, just get me a little bit of, you know, this and that so I can get the best possible placement, but I want it, right? You're in. And so I started doing research and putting together, like, you know, a book proposal. And that just meant initially just talking to Kenny Cox's parents, who I knew from the past. Kenny Cox, I should say, was once the best prep wrestler in the United States history. And eventually, after a college career that kind of didn't really work out the way he wanted, he kind of left civilization behind, searching for a way to be in the world. And that involved, at some point, you know, barefoot, dumpster dive, hiking and hitchhiking from Reedsport in Oregon, I'm sorry, from Florence in Oregon to Baja and back. And then when that wasn't enough, you know, spending 70 days in this deep sort of rugged jungle in Kauai's Nepali coast. And so, and then he died tragically. Not in exactly a Chris McCandless way. He survived to 70 days, but perhaps there were some consequences from what he had done. And so I started to consider the book and started talking to people who had known Kenny and loved him, and who I also happened to have relationships with, because I knew many of those people because they were elite Oregon wrestlers who I had grown up with. And
Like
either I was
you,
with,
because you were
yes,
too. Yeah.
right. Yeah, I went to Stanford on a wrestling scholarship. And so I had so wanted to be like Kenny Cox. And it started to open in me this sort of need to know what had happened to him. And because it, there was a part of me that had wanted to be him. And I had also carried, I think, some of those after effects that many people do who've ever been devoted to something really intense, right? Where I hadn't let go of being a wrestler, but you have to be more than just a wrestler, even if you were a championship wrestler like Kenny, right? Nobody wins forever. And valuing yourself in those ways and not having a sense of yourself beyond that, and then trying to figure out who you were in the world was something that I knew I wanted to understand, both for Kenny, but also for myself. And so I started to do that research. I whipped together a couple chapters in a proposal and went back to this editor 2 months later. And at that time, it looked like Bertelsmann International was going to acquire Simon & Schuster in a sort of semi-hostile takeover. And eventually, somehow that fell through, and instead they got acquired by a hedge fund, which is maybe even worse. But that editor suddenly did not have any latitude or any ability to take a risk on a book that didn't scream, celebrity memoir, 20,000 copies or more. And so I decided I was going to write the book anyway. That led me to about a four and a half year process of research, interviewing every single person that Kenny had ever sort of known and loved, travel specifically to Kauai, most especially, to try to, see the places that he had gone and see what I could discover, and figuring out a structure for this book. Because, I really didn't know that much. I had a little bit of contact with Kenny Cox in the years he was back in Eugene, but the truth is, much of his life was invisible to me, especially his personal life. And so, and I didn't really understand what had happened in the course of his journey and travels. And so it took me a lot to figure out and reconstruct those sections. But I think the part you're talking about, the sort of hard won, hard fought part, is that in the course of writing the book, there's, in addition to Kenny's story, a reckoning, as I sort of was alluding to, with myself. And the part of me that ever believed that, like, I don't know, a high school state championship, I should say, I lost seven, eight high school state championships in different styles of wrestling, including three straight in the big schools in Oregon, including 3-3 double overtime non-scoring tiebreak. I don't know if that's in the book, but I always somehow imagined that if I had been a champion, that would have made my life better. I think in Kenny's story, I see that the truth is that we have to be more than just, athletes. Even if we value or even have a deep love for the sports that we're dedicated to. Wrestling is a particularly fraught sport, but I do still love it. I just have to sort of realize that there are some consequences that came with pursuing it with the sort of abandon that I did, which was just a fraction of the intensity with which Kenny Cox pursued it.
If
So,
you're just joining us, you're listening to Bust the Canon on X-Ray FM. We're talking to author Michael Kopperman of the just published memoir Seeking Kenny that we're talking about now, which is about the extreme achievements demanded of young athletes and the cost of that pursuit. I'm wondering, I swear I'm going to get to the Bust the Canon questions, but I just want to ask one, and I'm fascinated just because it's fascinating. Because it's both about Kenny, but also about you. But also, I have a son who's very, very, very serious about basketball. And so a lot of this is resonant in the like a couple, like a, he's just under the age when a lot of this stuff is happening by just a couple of years. And as a parent, it's you see what it takes to even try to enter the arena in the same way as an elite athlete. And it's just, it's a scary, it's all encompassing. It asks everything of you. And so I also like I have a little skin in the game about all this. But I want to ask this. Because you're talking about in the book and also just now what it asks of you, what it costs, and what it delivers on the back end, whether you're a champion or not, is there any connection for you or similarity in being a writer? Now that you've transitioned from being a wrestler to being a writer, like, is there a similarity for you or is it really different? And if so, how?
so interesting. So I think, so I, me wanting to be a writer, I think probably predated me wanting to be a wrestler because I declared that I was going to be a writer at like, I guess like 5 years old or something. I was helped by the fact that my great grandmother, the writer and activist Emma Gelder Stern, who wrote, I think she wrote more than 20 Big Five books and a ton of pulp series nursing romance books to like make ends meet, but her real love was
Oh my
writing.
gosh, she'll make a killing. They should bring all those back in
They
print.
should bring them all back. But she also she wrote in this huge range. I mean, she wrote literally like the Knopf book about the March on Washington,
Oh my
about her
gosh.
friends, as she said. And she wrote like she was the first person to create a fictional version of the Amistad for
Oh my
children,
gosh.
actually. She wrote this like children's novel that's probably still in most libraries, public libraries that you can find. She wrote, this huge range of books, and I was like given to them to read as a kid. And so I guess I always saw that as viable. I should have realized that maybe it wasn't economically as lucrative as I imagined. Perhaps I just need to find my pulp nursing series.
Publishers are listening.
Yeah, yes, they are. But I will say that I think those two things have been related to me in certain ways. I think I think about them differently, but I didn't quite finish the story of how much it took me to write this book, right? 4.5 years to finish the book. Then in this new climate, and I've had four agents over time, right? It took me 9.5 months to secure an agent. And I ended up with like one of the very best nonfiction agents out there. And I had 13 full manuscripts and you know what I mean, like out, and ended up with like five offers. But everybody was waiting. Nobody was going to take a risk on anything that they don't think is going to sell. And that was so much worse than the last time I'd gone through that process. And then on market, my agent was 100% sure. He's basically a big five, almost big five only kind of an agent. He was 1,000% sure he was going to sell it. And so he kept trying and trying and trying with the contacts and lists that he had at big five. It was a year until we tried anybody in the indie world, and he really didn't have the connections there. So I feel really happy the University of Iowa has picked it up. They've actually been a dream to work with, and they're a wonderful boutique literary press.
They
But
are, they're tremendous.
it was looking bleak. At 18 months, my mental health was shot 18 months on sub, literally.
Talk about that. Is there a similarity between the, you were just mentioning you went to how many state championships and lost how many state championships being out on sub, which if you're not a writer, sub means submission. It means your book is out making the rounds from editor to editor, different publishing houses, and you're just in this vacuum of hearing nothing. And it's a very often painful and anxious period for most writers. And it's been especially pronounced, I'd say the last like 3 years. People go out on submission for like 9 to 12 months, just kind of normally now, which it didn't used to be like that, I don't think.
It didn't used to be like that. I mean, we're just in it's such a sort of crisis, especially for literary writers. And this is a total side question, right? But about who's willing to take a risk and publish those things. And there's less and less slots, there's less
No
and less
comment.
money.
No comment.
Yeah. Anyway, it's rough. But I think that's where my sort of dogged persistence comes in. I mean, the one thing about wrestling is that you don't quit, right? That's the one thing that you're not allowed to do. That's not always entirely healthy, but I think I learned how to persist under difficult circumstances and how to never give up. And with this particular book, I think I was saying this to myself over and over again, but like the one thing I can't do is quit on a book about Kenny Cox. The one quality that Kenny Cox had and embodied, which is sort of a central value in wrestling, is that you never give up. So to quit on a book about Kenny Cox would be like, I don't know, I guess quitting on like every single essence of my body and soul. And so I think in some ways I was actually helped for once with the wrestling part of the world going through the writing part of the process.
If you're just tuning in, you are listening to X-Ray FM. This is Bust the Canon, and I'm Margaret Malone. Today's guest is author Michael Kopperman, who's the author of the just out memoir Seeking Kenny and his earlier memoir Teacher, 2 Years in the Mississippi Delta. Okay, let's pivot to Bust the Canon questions I like to ask the guests. So, who is someone you feel is an overlooked author from the past, and you can define that however you want, that you want to share with us today, and then let us know why you think their work is, not as shined on as it should be.
Okay, so I've got it. I cut down my impulse to go with like seven authors or five authors. Or I think I've got it down to just a few. Okay, the first person that I really want to stan is my favorite poet, the Peruvian poet Cesar Vallejo, who only wrote two books of poetry. Died relatively young, in the late 1930s. In particular, what I am most drawn to, and I've read many translations, is the original place that I encountered Vallejo, I have to say, which was in a book that was published by a major press that were translations of in pairing Vallejo and Pablo Neruda, and they were all done by Robert Bly and James Wright,
My
right?
goodness.
Who
Wow.
were, of course, wonderful poets themselves, and I think this was, I don't think they're known for their translation, but it's not James Wright, I believe it is, but I just Something in the, I don't know how to put it, like the essence and quality of the poetry, like what you're sort of left with. Everything that Vaiho writes is so sort of like, I don't know, like soulful and authentic and meant and deeply felt. And you would sometimes think, well, okay, we'll get that, and then we end up with sentimentality. But there's nothing sentimental about Vallejo. He can be sort of dark, and there can be a melancholic sort of tone, and that can be a bit of a sad boy. But like, there's just something about his work that has stuck with me from the very beginning. I think I used a quote from one of his poems in Teacher to open it, right? There are some blows in life so violent, right? I can't answer. Like this idea of being just sort of muted. And of course, that language probably doesn't do justice to a wonderful romance language like Spanish, which unfortunately I don't speak.
I was about to ask, have you ever read it in Spanish? And it's
I
Homie.
have looked at, you know, at them and tried to have someone who was fluent read it out loud to me. But I just really, really love it, and I always keep coming back to it. There's something in Mayo's work that I think is like a sort of essential quality to literature of the sort that I want to sort of write. And I think I'm trying to think. A poet friend of mine once told me like I'm a little bit too baroque for the modern world, and that's probably true. But that's like what the ways that Vaiho does it. He just sort of does it right. So that's one person that I strongly encourage people to look at. But in particular, that translation. You know, Robert Bly has his character flaws in terms of some of his later political stands, but he certainly was a talented poet. Having a poet translate poetry, you know, you often don't end up with what is exactly the original work. And I don't know exactly how much of the filtering through the consciousness of these two, right, you know, sort of well-known poets is changing the essence of what's there. But I do know that what I sort of come away from it with is something that I really always return to when I'm empty or feeling sort of emptied and don't know what to write, you know, I can go
Why do
read
you
those poems.
think that if it's from an anthology that paired their work with Neruda, why do so many of us know who Neruda is and not Vallejo?
Yeah,
Am I pronouncing that right?
and that's a question that I'm sort of asked myself. And you know, I mean, Neruda is wonderful. Neruda's just not my jam.
Yeah, I
Not
feel
that I
you.
don't like, I mean, I've read a fair amount of Neruda, right? And yeah, it's sensual and it's beautiful and but it's somehow just not sort of like the essence of his project is not the thing that I'm interested in some way. And I don't know the answer to that, except to say that there wasn't as much of a body of work to participate in canon formation. There are formal innovations, and I know that scholars do study Vallejo. It's not like he's completely forgotten, right? Because he was very unique, but it was a small body of work. He died young, so you know it's kind of one of those situations. But I think he's well worth looking at. Okay, S
Okay,
second
there's
person.
more.
I'm gonna edit out my second, my third person. But I have to stand, and I think you'll understand why. The Black feminist writer and activist Toni Cade Mbara's fiction, and particularly her stories that were collected from a 10-year span sometime in the early 70s that is titled Gorilla My Love. And the reason for it is that those stories are almost all in first person, and they are written in African American vernacular English from the points of view of Black children, often growing up in, you know, relatively impoverished circumstances. And that resonates with me because of the 2 years that I spent in Rome, Mississippi, teaching in the segregated Black public schools there, and listening to those kids' voices. She has such a way of like insisting that those children keep their agency in those stories. They're not just acted on by the world, right? They're not just done violence, as I know that many sort of people have sort of discussed as being one of the problems, especially when we have writers who don't sort of understand what they're coming from, and they simply use the violences of poverty as a sort of plot mechanism or as a way of, you know, so what's the word we want, like something porn,
It's evocative. They do
right?
the same thing with women and girls, and they kill them off because we'll all pay attention.
Violence porn or poverty porn, right?
Totally.
So, but there's nothing that quality is not what comes through. What comes through instead is just the wonderful sort of aliveness and the poetry of those children's voices. And having the voices of kids from Mississippi sort of still seared into my brain all these years later, for good and bad reasons. But I did love those kids. I haven't found anything that so clearly sort of represents, I won't say represents their lives one to one. It's a 30-year gap, right, between when she wrote those stories or and when I taught in rural Mississippi. But I still find that like there's some essence or spirit of like kids, and in particular what it means to be, I think, a Black child in a certain kind of environment in the US and places that still exist, that she just captures. And I haven't really found anything that was, I don't know, that better does that, that better sort of reminds me of like the essence and spirit of those kids. So that's, I strongly suggest that if people haven't read it. I mean, she did lots of other wonderful work. She's responsible for like a bunch of anthologies of like queer and Black women, and Chicano women. I think she worked with Gloria Anzaldúa to create this like anthology that's still sort of seminal and intersectional feminist like, you know, narrative. But that book is the one that really gets me.
I love that book. I can like picture it on my shelf right behind me. It has an amazing cover. Well, the one I have, there's like a certain cover that's so evocative that I think of every time to talk about that book. Okay. Second question. Who is an, emerging or up and coming writer working today that you think we should know about that we might not hear about otherwise?
Okay, so I'm gonna go fiction. I'm sorry, I'm gonna go poetry because I, because my dirty secret is that I mostly read poetry.
Yeah, me too.
And
It's okay.
then, yeah, it's just like pure lyric fuel. Like, I don't have the
Yep.
craft, so I can't understand it the way I can with prose, where I'm doing all this thinking. And then I'm just like,
Totally.
oh, but it's beautiful and stunning. And it's like, it's sort of cheating. But
No, not at all.
yeah.
I get it.
So the poet Michelle Pendolosa, she is a dear friend of mine, but I felt that she simply hit another gear with her most recent book of poems, which is her second book of poetry. All the
What's
words I can, sorry, the name of it is All the Words I Can Remember Are Poems.
kind
She is, she's Filipina, and the book also contains a bunch of sort of original artwork and collage artwork that she sort of created. To go with some archival work that she did actually at the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor's repository of Filipino-American photographs from the Philippine War. And so
Wow.
the book is, on the one hand, this deeply personal sort of like matrilineal consideration of the ways that her grandmother's life, her grandmother who, you know, I believe immigrated, and her mother's life, and then her own life are sort of flow into one another and have these similarities and these frictions, right? And at the same time, the book is this deep, deep reckoning with like the American colonial violences in the Philippines and the Philippine American War that like we don't know about, most Americans don't know anything about. Hundreds of thousands of people were killed. You know, and so she does this, just these amazing things with form, and sometimes with ekphrastic poems where the photographs are pictures of like of basically like murdered Filipino resistance fighters, or their bodies just in heaps, right? Like almost evoking like the Holocaust. But she didn't want to use the images to sort of have shock value and to recreate those violences. And so some of the collage work she does, like she creates like beds of flowers or like funereal flowers to cover those bodies, so that you know you see their presence, but you also see that they're like sort of mourned, and so that she doesn't sort of recreate the violence over again. It's just an absolutely extraordinary collection. Really sort of like, you know, she's a younger poet, but sort of hitting that maturity, and there's a lot of really vulnerable personal things going on too in the book. Particularly with regards to her sort of reckoning with Boss, like wanting to have a future child and then understanding that perhaps she's not actually going to be able to, which is not something that I've seen a lot of people write about in poems. The book is really just wonderful. And so I strongly, strongly recommend it for people who want to read poetry.
Yes, and please read poetry if you think you might want to but haven't yet, because it may be more accessible than you have or assume in mind.
Yeah, that book, the book is super accessible, even though I know I'm making it sound like it's this academic recommendation. I mean, there's a wonderful poem about like going to like the dollar store and all the ridiculous things that people sort of have there, and her on a text thread with like her other best friends who are all like women of color, many all of them from immigrant backgrounds, and like about how they're getting like this pleasure out of this thing. It's just a wonderful, wonderful book. And then my other rec is the Indian writer Zara Chowdhury's The Lucky Ones. She was raised Muslim in Gujarat, and particularly in Ahmedabad. And she was, I think, 16 in 2002 when the Gujarat pogrom happened and went on, which was 3 months of basically mobs of Hindus in the streets, just like hacking people's bodies apart, and trying to seek people out. She and her family were like trapped in an apartment. But what she does that's extraordinary in the book that I think makes it so resonant is she lets us see her childhood self sort of retrospectively, but we really get a sense of that child who doesn't really understand what's happening, but who is experiencing it, and who also, her own family isn't perfect. She has an alcoholic father who was abusive to her mother and herself, and the women sometimes in her family have, are unkind to one another. But you get a sense of this family, and you get a sense of the situation, and then she goes into this sort of archival work of recovering the sort of humanity and experiences of a lot of the victims, who endured some absolutely horrific violences. But rather than just like sort of lingering in the violence, and this is like you know what I mean, this is like a genocide I didn't know about. She manages to sort of restore the humanity to those people by telling us who they were and what they believed in and what they fought for, and fought for, just meaning their lives in these cases. And it's a difficult book, but I mean, it was history that I really didn't have any understanding of. And what's interesting about it, I think, too, from a political perspective, and for us to understand and also to think about in this country, is that the person who fanned the flames of that violence and really enabled it, was Modi, right? Who is the strong man, fascist sort of like dictator who's overtaken whatever India's democracy is, right? By pitting religious factions against one another, and by promising, by leaning into certain sort of like biases, religious and cultural, right? And that was like the event that made him, that was the start. And now he runs the country. But the amount of blood that was sort of on his hands is quite extraordinary.
I didn't know about that. I've actually never heard of it until you talked about it. And I love the way that you linked the word archival to restoring humanity, because I've never thought about how that's exactly what archivists do. I've never thought about that. Like, that is the work of why people spend so much time in dusty basements and digging through things and interviewing people of, that are, related to people no longer alive. It's like, it's to restore the humanity of the document, the writing, the thinking, the person. It's really incredible. Thanks for making that link for me. I'd never connected that before.
I think we, and I think I still have that image, right? That like dusty archives, librarian-ish person, random things that are just arranged. But also, those are the things that are the documentation, right? Of people's lives, and in many cases, like people suffering. And so I think it's sort of, actually, I think the combination of these two projects sort of made me understand that better and more clearly, because I was like, well, so if these records weren't there, right? And if no one goes through them to do that work, to unearth, right, what the meaning of those things, and to make it live, then then maybe they are just papers to someone kept. But I think the work of people who go into them and do that sort of work is really extraordinary. So
Amazing. And I'll say this again at the end of the show, but if you're looking for information about any of the writers or books or anthologies we've talked about today, it'll all be on the website, along with the link to the full episode. This is Bust the Canon. You're listening to X-Ray FM. I'm Margaret Malone, and today's guest is Michael Kopperman, author of the memoirs Teacher, 2 Years in the Mississippi Delta, and the just published memoir Seeking Kenny. Okay, let's get to the question. What are your thoughts about the canon? Is there a canon? What is it? Does it matter to you? Does it not? Like, because you're back, like pause for a second. Background. I know this about you because I know you, but a listener will not. You are a long time teacher and professor for all different kinds of folks from now all over the country. And so this question to you, I feel like, is especially interesting because I'm guessing, perhaps, have you had to teach the canon? Have you chosen to teach the canon? And also, is there a canon? Okay, go.
Well, so I think there are ways in which we sort of are asked to teach the canon. So for the 16 years that I got to basically teach creative nonfiction to first generation college students of color, I basically tried to find texts without sort of playing, that diversity like bingo. I wanted to have the exemplars of excellence be work that reflected the backgrounds of my students. And so, we did read some wonderful white writers, but a lot of them, because they were essays or poetry, were reflecting working class backgrounds, right? Or were trying to get at things that I felt like were especially sort of relatable. And most of those exemplars for me were writers who were Indigenous and Black writers and, and immigrant writers of all sorts of stripes. And so I sort of got to recreate that canon in that very small, 2-quarter semester space. But
How
yeah.
much arm wrestling did you, no pun intended, how much like did you have to do to let your curriculum be what you wanted it to be versus what they were asking you to do? I know
Right.
that's
So, I mean, I was hired supposedly with this expertise, right?
a Okay.
But I learned that what you do is you hide what you're doing, and then you can do what you want to do as long as you
I've
do it well.
heard that before.
And so I get my head down after being censured a couple of times for, like not particularly wanting to spend most of my class centered around the teaching of this thing called the enthymeme, which is, a vaguely Greek or Latinate nonsense word that was created by U of O professor to take a logical syllogism that exists in philosophy and turn it into some sort of mechanistic thesis statement that then gives you counter argument. It's like, I don't find this to be particularly useful or compelling in terms of being a way to think. And so I'm going to say I'm doing that. And I'm going to teach Zora Neale Hurston today. And that to the side of it, I mean, I had no understanding of what a canon was even when I was in college or grad school, which is interesting.
Is interesting.
I was very, well, I mean, I was in creative writing at Stanford, which is a wonderful place to study creative writing because the Stegners are who teach you. So they're these young, super hip, right? Like ZZ Packard was one of my teachers. You know what I
Oh,
mean? Like,
wow. Yeah.
you get a different sort of, I got a different version of that. But I realized that I was getting a heavily Western canonical sort of like largely undergrad,
Right.
except that the scholar Arnold Rampersad was a wonderful, he's a African American biographer, and he's done work for a bunch of really big literary figures. I like took African American literature with him, right? It's like, what's cooler than when he's talking about, James Baldwin, and he's like, oh, James does this, and James used to say this, and it's like, oh, James, okay.
Oh my gosh.
But I mean, I'm saying that just to point out that like when I was 20. Five and finishing, or 26, I guess, and taking this exam that they had for the MFA, which they reformed after my experience, actually. I think I'm the only person to ever fail 2 out of 3 questions on the MFA exam. They give you a week to answer 35, or sorry, to write 35 pages on like 3 different questions. And one of those questions, I should say, I shouldn't have failed any of them, but the one in particular that I failed was about the canon. And you were supposed to choose 4 writers to write about who were in the canon. But we had never discussed the canon, except in terms of what we learned from one of our professors, who is a brilliant, brilliant teacher and a brilliant writer, but who had one of the most narrow and classical senses of what is good and what is not good that you've ever heard, right?
It's
Like literally, there was Chekhov, there was Tolstoy before he became, Christian and didactic. There was Bernard Malamud and Flannery O'Connor, and Alice Munro was the only contemporary person capable of carrying the torch. And Raymond Carver was pretty good. And
Wow.
that was it in this professor's estimation, right? Of like what was sort of like good, like this very, very concrete, incredibly finely honed sense of what things were. Like he caught my answer by chance. He was the grader for my canon question. And I had chosen James Baldwin as one of my four authors.
Go, baby.
And in his estimation, James Baldwin was not in the canon. And that is to say that in order to like have the thing pass, I had to go back and make a case, which was not very difficult to do. I just used some Henry Louis Gates's foreword to my anthology of African American literature from college. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Makes an argument, but the argument being that canon formation is active, right, and ongoing, that it is going to be different and represents the different experiences and material conditions, and as well as the historical sort of situations that we find ourselves in. Arguments that I think in some ways Matthew Salas has followed up with in Craft in the Real World, in some ways, in talking about craft as not being this neutral tool, right? But it's always being active. And I think about that, or I think about what Matt's saying about craft, that's an old friend. And then what it means to sort of have a canon in the first place, who decides that canon, who creates it, who gets canonized and lionized, who gets taught, right? None of these things exist or come about by accident. And so I count me in for busting the canon. That doesn't mean that we have to abandon the texts that have existed before, but surely we need more because we are more. And not in this reductive, sort of like tokenist way that I think frequently happens, especially in academia, where they're like, well, we only get one text represent this one thing. So here's our, you know what I mean? Here's our this person to fit this slot and this person fit this slot. And there's got to be more because it takes a whole ecosystem to create these things and make them and sustain them, right? So I don't know the answer. But I do know that, like, I'd always been a good and diligent student, and like I was good at the academic part of it. I'd never failed anything written in my entire life, I don't think, until I
Did
supposedly
you
did not understand what the canon was.
do you remember at the time? I mean, I wouldn't have understood this question at the time as a younger person. It's only been the last 5 years, 5 to 7 years, I've really deeply thought about this stuff, which is why the show exists. By the way, if you're friends with Matthew Salas, will you tell him his book, Craft in the Real World, is one of the reasons I wanted to have this radio show on because of the work done in that book. Okay.
I'll tell him that I've seen AWP this year.
Yes, please tell him. Do you think that our definition of the canon has like, did you understand at the time when you were failed for not identifying canonical writers? Did you agree? Like, do you remember whether you agreed or not? Or were you angry? Like, what?
I was unwilling to abandon James Baldwin. So, but I don't see that that was out of an understanding that was greater than that. Does that make sense? Like,
Yes, absolutely.
I was just kind of like, I was kind of like, well, James Baldwin is famous and wonderful. So why wouldn't he be in the canon? And
Right.
I had this, but I had this vague sense that there was a canon because, I'd been an English major who'd had to study the medieval period and restoration literature. God help me, I hate illustration literature. And like, and modernism, and to read Chaucer at some point. I love Shakespeare. Who doesn't love Shakespeare? But like, it was like I had this like vague sense that there were famous writers, but I can't say that I had particularly troubled the notion of a canon or a singular canon, right? Or what it means to, right, to say there's, okay, well, there's a canon of African American literature, right? Well, why isn't Zora Neale Hurston in the canon of American literature? Because Their Eyes Are Watching God is a masterpiece, right? So, like, I think lots of people are insisting on more, but active forces that we see right now in our country that are trying to push back and recreate and reinstantiate this kind of classical white male canon
And
in it
Success
successfully.
successfully happening right now.
Well, the only way you can do that is if you erase history, And of course, if you're a racist in history, it's probably a precursor to racist people. And I guess all of these things are happening. So,
We need the archivists who are going to restore humanity in real time while we're here. Okay, so that leads me to the last question, which is, so what's one step we can take as individuals, as writers or readers to, bust what's not working about the canon or what we can change? How do we break it up? How do we bring new voices in?
and I think the, I think well, so I think it's hard to read to deconstruct the canon, though I think critiques of the historical canon are important. I think what we can, and by deconstruct, I just mean we can't like get rid of that thing existing. What we can do, I suppose, is trouble it or insist that what we read today and that what we celebrate, as I was sort of saying, as being extraordinary, right? We can do so in a way that lifts up many and that considers other experiences without engaging in some sort of reductive, Baldwin hated the idea that anything that he wrote was sh or should be considered good because it was about blackness, right? Or about a critique of those things. He wanted those things to be lifted up because they were beautiful, meaningful, and extraordinary, right? That the craft that created them was worthy. And I'm not talking so much about his essays as more like, you know what I mean, his fiction. But he has a bunch of reviews. If you've read, I don't know if I even fit. I read as much of his collected essays as I could. It's one of the biggest books I've ever seen. But a bunch of his early work is literally, I'd say, are reviews. And sometimes he's like savaging,
I can
like
see
the newest
that.
hot
I can see that.
because he's like, this isn't good enough. Do you know what I mean? Right? This is hot because it gives you the version of the world that's easy that you think you want. That some white editor picked up, and it doesn't tr particularly trouble them what's here because there's not enough humanity here, right? And so it's not that we need to be celebrating books because they are from other experiences. We need to be celebrating books because they're excellent and making sure that we're paying attention to those other experiences because those people's lives matter too, because they're a part of our, what I still hope is a shared and common project, assuming that we make it out of this thing alive.
TBD, Mike. TBD. Yeah, it's really interesting to link the canon to just the idea of humanity and how there has been, decisions made and work done to limit the canon, intentionally sometimes and unintentionally others, and how that erases, limits, shades away the humanity of so many people, over the years. And I'm completely hooked now on this. I'm at this idea of the archive and how to restore humanity. And I just feel like, I don't know, like a redefinition of what the canon is a version of archiving, I think. I think it might be. I don't know. I still don't know how I feel about the canon, even after all these interviews and thinking so much about it. I'm fascinated by the idea of it, and I don't know what I think.
I think my concern with the concept is that it assumes that there ever can be a single body of work that someone could define. Because I'm just worried that if that someone is being influenced by power, right? And power reflects the inequalities and structures of our country that are historical and contemporary and persist, then it becomes not a hopeless project, like maybe a sort of impossible project to ever have that, to ever have all of those experiences that we want to include there and give an equal weight, or give an equal weight to something that has already been lionized and said to be great and held to be great and taught to be great. But maybe that's also like a too negative of a take. Right, maybe we can have a little bit more hope than that. That like, I do see this younger generation insisting that they don't just want to see and read, for lack of a better word, like the white male stories, right? Or white male straight stories, especially. I mean, we got queer hockey now. It's not just hockey, right?
Beloved all over the world.
So maybe there is room enough for all of us. But yeah, I don't know how that stacks up against the quote unquote canon, because if people like to think about it in such sort of scholarly, weighty, serious terms, is that there was like some professor out there who was like single-handedly determining what is or is not in the canon.
Well, it's so funny because when I was a really small kid, I had this idea that the way words were invented was that there was like a cloud somewhere in the sky that I guess I thought was near God or something, whatever I thought that was at the time. And they sat on a cloud in chairs, and then of course, and I didn't understand till later. It was they're all like old white men that look like Abraham Lincoln, I guess. They'll have long beards. They're sitting on clouds, and they make up words. They like say a sound, and then they're like, "And this means like ficus. This means this is a plant with the green leaves." And I literally thought that's how words were invented. And it's funny now because I feel like there is a version of the canon that is that in a way. It's like, and so I give you this canonical book, and so it is. Like that is a little bit of what the canon is. So it's funny to me now, but it's as weird as that in some ways. It's like it's yeah, that's a good book, and there's thousands of other good books as well that maybe could be up here in the word
Yeah,
canon.
it's just such an interesting thing. I mean, I guess it's just like refocusing, I guess, sometimes, not because someone is of an alternate experience, but just considering, I don't know, what greatness or invention is. It's cool to see Mary Shelley have her moment. Everybody knows Frankenstein, right? Because somehow that became a canonical work. But like, a few people know that she also wrote a book called The Last Man that is like the original dystopian post-apocalyptic survivor book,
Never
right?
read.
Like I mean, she created different many genres independently. It's like when she's like a teenager in her young 20s. I just think that sometimes we could pay attention to those people and give them a little bit more attention, and I guess maybe that's happening sometimes. But you
It's
think about
happening.
how many people have how much excellence was created and then excluded or never found an audience along the way, so that it never reached the point, right, that it becomes.
That's the part that kills me. It's the people will never know. And that's why I always encourage listeners of this show and people I know to read in translation, because at least there's access. We can get access now if we keep like buying books, asking for books, more and more books will be translated. It's such a tiny, tiny sliver of what is being written worldwide that is translated into English as it is. So keep all of us need to keep reading, keep asking, keep being curious. Mike, thank you so much. I'm so grateful that you took the time. I know your schedule is packed as you're promoting your book. I'm so grateful. Thank you for being on the show. Thank you for your thoughts and sharing all these writers with us. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much for having me. This was an awesome conversation, and I look forward to continuing our conversation on July 8th
Yep.
at
If you want to hear
6:30 at
more,
Literary
yeah.
Arts.
Yep. Literary Arts. And I'll put that on my Instagram too. Mike's promoting his book, Seek and Kenny. I'll be in conversation with him. Once again, thank you so much for being here. Thank you for listening to Bust the Canon. If you want to learn more about Michael Kopperman or any of the writers we talked about, I will list them all on the Bust the Canon website. And you can listen again to this episode on the X-ray page. Thank you for listening. We will be back the first Monday of August. See you then.